Okay, this is for welcome. This is for all the persons online watching this online. That's why we are in this very small, crammed room. It's not only for because it's cozy, but it's also because somebody is watching online. And you can also download or watch it afterwards, so it records. Now, I don't know more than... let's see here. I can show you that immediately because... let's see here. When we're done, here you can see Frode's lecture from earlier this morning is already here. But afterwards you can find it. And it's at hig.no. That is an historical reason for that. But the point is you can see it afterwards. And also all persons that take this course online or as distance, on a distance, of course you can you can follow us live, but you can also watch it afterwards. So and also where you can watch it, that is also interesting maybe. And then you have, see here, yes, if you Google NTNU and CO25, this room, you find this site. So now it should be streaming. Is it? No, it's not. Should we do something about this or? Computer? Okay. 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 You can show me later. I will, just in case, I will do it a backup here. So I put on my voice recorder. So, in case nothing else works, you will have a voice recorder. Okay. Then, let's see here. Is it necessary to have this on the? Can you put off the light? Yeah. Is that too dark, or can you still? I hope it's fine for people online, but anyhow. All right. Welcome then to the course Usability and Human Factors in Interaction Design. And I know you are people here from the Master Program in Interaction Design, but we also have some other students. And so when we work in groups, we have to see how we deal with that. But I think if it's fine for you, who are on-campus students, I think it's great that you mix between the study programs. But we will discuss that later. I'm Anders Petter Andersson, but I also have Frode Volden here, and he will be lecturing later at 11 o'clock. And you also have Øyvind, who is a Jaksnes, who is a student assistant, a second year student in interaction design. And the interaction designers have met him before. He was father, which basically means father in Norwegian, isn't it? Yeah. So you have met him, but he's a second year student. He knows how you do everything, and he's a great source of also what to expect in this course. And he will be helping me and Frode and Sashi, who is another person here, and Sebastian, to make also a lot of practical exercises and get you going. So, and Sebastian Brage Hansen, you will meet him next week. He's working in the industry in Dagbladet, a big newspaper, and he's an interaction designer. So we'll meet him next week. But why we do this? This course is to introduce interaction design, user and human factor. It's about you forming, and now I think both you interaction designers taking the program, but everybody that's interested in interaction design, to form a common understanding. And to do that, interaction designers work in teams, in groups. This is something you can't rely on your own expertise. Then you make excellent systems or excellent design for your own, for you. But most other people are not you, so it's not. I think somebody calls it I design. It's not ego design, but it's it's design for other people mostly. And this course is also about sketching. Get your sketching up to snuff. Get your doing interaction design and discussing up to snuff. And all of you come from different backgrounds. So you have absolutely something to contribute. You have resources. But it's only when we share them that and that's when we practice. And practicing sketching in interaction design can be sketching on paper, but it can also be most of all, meeting people, going out, immerse in other users' experiences. Get your hands dirty, so to speak. And what we will do, we will, as one of the books says, go beyond human-computer interaction. It's the book Interaction Design. And beyond human-computer interaction, and as you have seen, maybe how many of you have been able to look at the material at Blackboard or page? Not everyone. Huh? That's something. Then we have to see to that everybody can watch what we what I as a teacher assume that you do. And we will talk about a bit about that, but this is a course where you read the literature before the lecture. So we actually want you to read the literature, not the last week in the end of the course, but before each lecture, because we will focus on discussion. It's also a question for me. I'm coming from aesthetics. I'm a musician, sound designer, musicologist, doing interaction design. And for me, interaction design has nothing to do with the human-computer interaction. It has to do with the human interaction. And can you really design user experiences? This is one of the very essence, the core of my questioning this course and this theme. What about the user's right to interpret and decide for himself or herself? Can you design a user experience? I would question that at every point. I say, you as a designer can design for user experiences. You can never design UX. That's a horrible thought, I think, if you take a humanistic perspective. Otherwise, you can talk about design for living. As one of the podcasts, we'll get back to it, one of the podcast suggestions I had, the woman behind Holzblatt, behind Contextual Design, a very influential book, comes out in the second edition now. And it says, user, yeah, what about the user? How do we look at the user? Is it a person? Is it just an account? Somebody that brings money to you as an interaction designer, or what? Yeah, we will discuss themes like this during the course, and of course we will get loads of inspiration from Frode and Sashi and
me and Öyvind and so on also during the course. How we will do this? If we decided based on students' comments and complaints from last year, we have expanded the days we meet here. And it's unfortunate for people online, you could say, well, I'm not sure. I think we will organize something, and I will arrange a special Skype meeting with you guys online, so that we also form groups. And even if you can't meet on Wednesday and Thursday, maybe your group online, your off-campus students, can meet other times. So we will form form groups. So apart from the four two-day seminars, we will have group tasks that you do in groups from 2 to 3, 4 people, depending on how we divide it after this session. And there you will be sketching, doing discussion, immerse the users in interaction with them. So that's the point. And you will also, the group task is about also delivering half a page, something like that, written. So you will get the written feedback on your written assignment as well. But that's group. Then you have the individual home exam. So I will get more into detail into this, but in the end of the course, which is in the beginning of middle of October, so it's fairly short course, this, you will have a take-home exam that you write on your own at home. We will use a lot of methods, sketching, user experience methods, studies, research, and we will also be using the Makerspace, the new design workshop, design workshop, that's in room A259. So we have some scheduled lectures there, so we will actually be teaching that. But already now, it's open every Wednesday from 3-4. Today from 4, so we will be there the last part of the day. But approximately from 3 to 7 every Wednesday. And then you can share it with other students, engineers in engineering, bachelor students in interaction design and graphical design and so on. And of course all of you, also people at taking courses in computer science and so on. All of you are welcome. Yeah, I should. I said already something about the live streaming, so that you can watch the recordings afterwards. The Blackboard course page. I will say something about that. We also need a reference group, 2 to 3 student representatives, and what you will be doing is hand in. Two times, I think it is, 2 or 3 times during the course, you will have a short meeting and two, three of you, and you will discuss what is good, what is bad, and you will post it on, I guess we will have to have a sort of a Facebook page or something for the class, for the course, but you post it there so we can change things immediately, and then you write half a page in the end of the course. As a final evaluation. Do we have 2-3 people here that are interested? It's not very much work, and it's very good for you because we can change things immediately if it's something that doesn't work. 1 person? 2? 3? Are you taking the computer science? No? Yeah? So we are all interaction designers. Is it somebody from computer science that wants to? We can be 4. Please, come on, 1. You okay? Very good. So you can come to me afterwards. We write the names and so on. Excellent. So about the schedule, I want to say something about the schedule. Today, it's the introduction and focus on guidelines. And and Frodo will be taking the part on guidelines. And in the afternoon we will have a workshop, and I know you want to go, so do you want to say something about what we will be doing in the workshop? I will be there as well, but...
Oh, okay. We'll do a short workshop about usability and user experience goals, and something practical, a bit sketching, prototyping, that sort of thing. Yeah, so that's after lunch, I believe. Yeah, so I'll see you after lunch.
Okay, thank you, Eivind. Bye bye.
All right. Tomorrow there will be a focus on human factors, perception, and Frode will also talk about perception, visual perception, maybe mostly. Yeah? No? Okay. And I will talk something about auditory perception and make some exercises with you. And for somebody, how many here has a music or sound background or are singing, or how many here are interested in music? You don't like music? Not so much, okay. There are some percentage that doesn't like music, that's fine. But maybe my point is, you don't have to be an expert in music to know about sound perception, but you can learn it. And so it's about broadening your knowledge into that field, how you can go about understanding people that have a hearing aid, for example. Okay. Wednesday next week, there will be a focus on web content and guidelines, also accessibility guidelines. And you know, Norway is very strict. There are laws, so a commercial company needs to have followed guidelines when it comes to universal design of screen interface and so on. And to help us with that, we will have Sebastian from the industry, also again, learning, say something about, he will give a lecture, but mostly he will have a practical workshop on the techniques and methods he is using in the industry to work with these things, with customers. So that will be very practical. And Thursday then, there will be again Frode, who look at the cognitive walkthrough and PACT and give a lecture on that, and we will be working with that practically afterwards as well. Yeah. Okay, yeah. The thing is, we can go on, and you can have this PowerPoint afterwards, but all this information is also out on the blackboard. So you find there's nothing new here, really. But just to continue a bit faster, human factors, attention and memory. Here you will have Sashi, associate professor, also in interaction design, who is actually the expert in human factors, I would say. He will give the human factors course, second human factors course in the spring, I think it is. And it's about multimodal and embodied perception. also. And as you see here, Johnson and Rogers, the two books we have, they follow through here. So you can prepare, and we want you to prepare and read those chapters. Even if you skim them, you will have much more interesting discussions when you meet up here. And it will be more interesting for your colleagues here, your students. So, and on the Thursday 21st, we will have a prototyping workshop, again with Sebastian and me, and Mix, that means Øyvind, the student assistant. So we will really get immersed in the design workshop in A259, and we will have a lot of sketching techniques and that you can use directly into the task you will be doing also. And then with the last part, there will be on the 5th of October, Human Factors Learning and Problem Solving. Again, Sebastian will be there and do practical exercise on how he deal with problem solving together with the customer that maybe doesn't want to see the problem, how you can deal with learning and how you actually develop an interface or a system or a service that is following is open to different learning, diverse learning, people with learning disabilities, for example, but also people on experts on very high levels, how you deal with that. And the last Thursday, there will be an evaluation workshop where we also learn how to evaluate. So it's the evaluation of the course, but it's also the evaluation methods you can be using and how you can think about that evaluation when it comes to human factors, when it comes to universal design, when it comes to evaluation, how you design evaluation. So, yeah, we've gone through this group five tasks. 500 to 1,000 words. What you will send in will be commented by mainly me and Sashi. And it's 60% of the grade. Individual take-home exam is maximum 3,000 words. 40% of the grade. And of course, we expect pictures and illustrations and tables and all the data that you can get in. But it's not so many words. But it's again. Sketching is also word sketching, so you need to write in this course. And the tasks, there are examples from last year on Blackboard, but the first task that is due already on Monday, I think it is, and when it says September 5th, it's midnight from the 5th to the 6th of September. But that's why it's pretty quick, you will get going. And you could say, the first one is an assessment of Blackboard using heuristics. And all this is in the literature that you had for today and tomorrow. So the second task is about inclusive design or universal design, how you include people with some sort of disability. The third is about users, identify the main users of Blackboard, techniques and methods for doing that. It's something we have been working with Sebastian and so on before that. And it's also about making a cognitive walkthrough that you have had a lecture with Frode about. You have doing some solutions, coming up with solutions or designing concepts and make a sketch. And of course, this is also tied to this prototyping workshop that we have. So you will have a lot of skills on how to do going from paper to wireframes and different software you can be using. And you will have a full training from by Øyvind how you can use the softwares, and there's a lot of free softwares that you can use and how you use it when presenting and together with the customer and so on. We will go through all the practical stuff for that. I'm very fond of you collecting projects, sketches and so on in a sort of a portfolio, but also methods. So you have a lot of methods up your sleeve when you meet the customer and you need to improvise and so on. I want you to come to, so if you see this course as something, you build up a portfolio of different methods, different techniques, a good project. Yeah? No, online. But you will be making things physical. So, and of course here you will upload it. You will write about it. But you can also upload, you can scan the paper prototypes you make and so on and upload them. But I focus very much on this, so on the sketching, and I found sometimes that you have very different backgrounds. But if you're not used to sketching, you have to learn it, and you can't go make a concept. You cannot have one or two ideas sketch and limit them to one, and then make one prototype. That's not serious. That's bullshit, to be fair, to be honest. I mean it, because then you don't take the user seriously, you don't take the task seriously, and you will not become a good interaction designer. So you need to learn to sketch and to do things over and over and over again. Are you coming back at 11? Yeah? But 11, is that okay? Or 10 past 11, that's good. Okay. Then the final reflection is to go through the different things you have done and to look at the sketches, look at all the methods, look at all the discussions and the group work and so on, and the process and generally. And then you make an evaluation. Yeah, we're through that. I'm very, very happy for that, and I'm happy for you that you take this serious, because it's very good for us teachers to know that not to wait until the end of the semester, but to say. Last this week, yesterday's lecture could be, or this doesn't work for us. So, who here could organize a Facebook group? Isn't that the, or do you have some other suggestions? Slack, or I'm open to everything, but you want to use Slack? Maybe you can show us in the afternoon. But we have to make a sort of a group for that. Yeah. Maybe Facebook, yeah? No, okay. We can do both. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. For me, it's easy with Facebook, because most people have it. But we could do both. And in this course, it actually makes sense to have test tryouts. You will try out Blackboard, whether you like it or not. But I sometimes call it black box, because what you put in, you don't know really what happens, but something comes out. But no, I shouldn't be negative. The point is that. The more systems, the merrier. You shouldn't say, oh, it's as many systems. You say, yes, it's another system. Yes, a ticket machine that doesn't work. Yes, I can. Now I can test my skills as an interaction designer and evaluate it. About the discussions, we will have a break. So we will have a break at 11. But what the course literature takes up, design with a mind in mind, bit of cognitive psychological theories in use in interaction design, and the interaction design beyond human-computer interaction. It's fine, but this is only something to start you off. And good and poor design, Rogers speaks about here. I mean, you have to discuss it. This is a very influential book. This is a potential dangerous book, because everybody follows it. This becomes the standard. And I'm not really agreeing with. I shouldn't say what my point is, but standpoint. But I can do that also. But good and poor design, that is debatable. And depending on culture, depending on background, understanding, age, man or woman, this is up to debate, really. And you as an interaction designer, you can be the advocate of the user. You can take the role. You should be not only empathic, but compassionate. You should take up the feelings of the user in yourself. You should be able to detect and understand when somebody speaks about cool design in smartphone, iPhone apps and so on. What do they mean? Cool? Isn't that redundant? Do we use that? Cool? That doesn't mean anything. Yeah, for that user it does. And it makes him want to use the phone 10 hours a day. He won't even leave it when he goes to the bathroom. You know this? Yeah? So, and also I have a question about user experience design, as I told you. So, can you really design user experiences? Of course not, I would say. That is a horrific idea. But we will talk about that. It doesn't mean that UX isn't important. It's immensely important. But let's be a bit less power eager here and egoistic. But so it's about human empowerment. And to get empowered is very important to the government of Norway when it comes to universal design. It's a goal of making universal design in Norway, to empower the users that are otherwise left out or are neglected and so on. But empowerment is something good for everybody. And it also means that you can get disempowered. So it's something about systems making us feel apathic, that we are small people, like a little screw in a big machinery, and suddenly we stop, we don't want to engage and so on. So what you are going to learn is, and what you are doing already perhaps, is very important. To empower people that are humans, not users. They are not only using a service, they are living their lives. It's important. And also, you could talk about the technological challenges. Being that screw in the machinery, when it comes to Internet of Things, mobile and social media, we are used to facing these technologies all the time. Sometimes I feel like very lost when something is new, and I don't have time to use it. But you are just constantly emerged in these new technologies that you just have to use them. And for us teachers, maybe not so much for you students, but for our teachers, the change from front to blackboard is a big thing, because everything is new. You can say it's another e-learning system. There are many e-learning systems. Get used to it. Yeah, but if you're my father, a carpenter, retired, this is a huge thing. He can't use it. He couldn't use Fronted either, but but I mean, it would be a challenge. So we have to look at that. And I have some ideas how we can face this from a historical point of view. And of course, you could talk about design for life. This is Karen Holzblatt. I urge you, and also off-campus students, listen to this fantastically knowledgeable, wise woman who wrote this contextual design book for 19 years ago. It's now out in a new edition. And why we don't have it as a course literature, that is something to discuss in the reference group. But I think it's an excellent take on this. You have to take in the context. You can't only focus on the iPhone. You have to take in the context what happens around the person using it. And you also design for life. With all those mobile, you don't work when you sit at your laptop. You work when you're on your mobile phone, using Slack to some of your friends, but also to your colleagues. And so the context and life and work are mixing. So we design for life, not for a work situation. I use my laptop, and it's fine that the website looks nice on the laptop. But what about the Blackboard app on the smartphone? Does it work? This is something you should analyze. But I mean, you know this, and if you take Blackboard to the bathroom, you actually use you working on the bathroom also, but you do other stuff in the bathroom. I won't go into details, but you understand what I mean. And I could take you from human factors to co-creative cross-media. I will get back to that because I have some slides. So what is interaction design? All those questions is in chapter 1 in Rogers. Chapter 9, the second chapter for today, reading assignment, is about the process of interaction design. So what processes are involved in interaction design? The practice of interaction design. A lot of different practices. Psychologists, interaction designers, industrial designers making the shell of a smartphone. You have user organizations, you have political people, you have marketing people, you have sometimes the marketing cost. I think the marketing cost for Apple products is bigger than the development cost. Of course, you would say, but it says something about who has the power. So it should actually say not praxis, but practices, a lot of practices involving interaction design. And the chapter 15 in Rogers is about evaluation, inspection. Inspection is also the title of the first assignment, the task you have. It's also about there are heuristics for doing evaluations. There are guidelines for doing evaluations, walkthrough methods for doing it. But when it comes to these heuristics, they are built on models, and models can be questioned. And I think Rogers is doing a good work in making you think about how you can question the model. But you have to understand, a model doesn't come down from God and is given, but it's something that you add to and you can change. And depending on who you work with, you will change it. So, lastly, back a bit to the co-creative cross-media. And this is about challenges and technological innovation. And sometimes we get very short-sighted. We think that mobile media and social media is something new, but it's not, if you guess. The Nomad in Africa, in Namibia, some of the oldest cultures in the world, because we came from Africa, if you didn't know, they have mobile media and have had it since the morning of times. So they have small jewelry on them that is also a musical instrument that they use to this is in the desert of Namibia, so they use it for collecting rain, of course, and getting the gods to give rain. It's also their bank with a lot of coins that they get from trading with Westerners and so on in recent years. So it's sort of, it's a valuable thing, it's a musical instrument, and it's a magic thing that they can use when they call for rain. This is a mobile media. It's not digital, it's not a smartphone, but it's as mobile as this. They are nomadic, so they walk all the time, so they bring it with them. It's not something new. So I would say that with recent years, if we look maybe the last 100 years of human factors and interaction design, we've gone from technical tools, objects, and instruments to do mobile, social, embodied, maybe I should say also for life or cross shifting context, but cross media, where we different media cross audio, video, interaction, the mobile, stationary, and so on. And we also have gone from use to being co-creative, and not only using what has given been given us, but we want to engage, we interact, we play, and so on. Yeah, the last one is, yeah, that's one take of it, help promoting. But that is not so important. Sorry, the other way. So, human factors come from human scale. And this is Dreyfus in the 30s. A sketch of somebody driving. And if you really get back, and I'm a musicologist, meaning I'm a historian, so I like to look at the history when I look at the future, if you follow me. So you could say go from oral communication to cross-media co-creation. And oral communication, it's theaters, it's about rituals, singing, it's a community thing, and you've done it as far as we have been human. And so it's your oral communication, and we will go all the way to cross-media, very fast. And from oral communication to mass communication, where the book, to wireless, one-to-many, where the radio in the 20s, 30s, very important in this Second World War. Then we comes to the machine-human interaction when with industries, the computer augment the communication. So, and then we get the network, we get in 93, the first browser with so ordinary users can be not only military, but also the academics, but also normal users. Mobile communication, social communication with Facebook and Twitter and so on, and cross-media embodied co-creation with Internet of Things. And I will take it step by step here. So, from theater, something happened in 1450 in the Western countries. But I know there are somebody here from China, and you actually had book printing already in 1045. And so something wasn't really good with the communication between West and the East in those days. So and we were basically barbarians back then. This is the time of the Vikings. So actually we traveled a bit, but we didn't understand so much, obviously. So you were much earlier. But it's the point is you got what was fantastic with this was you got from an esoteric, it was monks in Western countries writing every single word by hand, sitting in cloisters. They were writing in Latin. Nobody else understood what they were writing. And then you got the book and the book print. And in 1450, that book print spread the word in all the different languages that people spoke in their own tongue. So Germans could understand in German, Norwegians in Norwegian, eventually, and so on. So it was an immensely technological development that led to communication. With the radio, the wireless, it is called in UK, you get the wireless communication. And it's a military invention often military inventions are the start or after military inventions, you get it spread into the field of normal use. The TCP/IP protocol that is used for internet is actually comes from ARPANET and the American military. So we have a lot to think to thank the military for. And also the tape recorder was a device for deciphering codes and sending codes over the internet in World War II. And the tape recorder, nobody now uses a tape recorder, but for me growing up, this was how you copied and made your own music. And now, of course, we have the tape recorder in the computer. And then you get to the human scale and human factors. And that's really a need based on making machines and making when more people during the war and before the war, when more people are needed into and when you before the war, before the 30s, it was very much manual labor in the factories, but more and more machines came into the factories, more and more people had to interact with machines. So then this, what is the beginning of interaction design really, I would see as the need for understanding how you can interact with the machine. It began in the Ford factory in US and so on. And then something also happens, I talked about ARPANET, in Stanford in California, when the Stanford Research Institute, they, in 1968, they have a legendary, we will watch it some day, legendary wireless sending in 1968 from one campus in Stanford to another one. Where they have a mouse, they have a screen interface with windows that they can move windows around on the screen, and they have a talkback system, and they have actually a mouse where they can write things with chords, like playing on a piano. But the thing is, in 1968, they have all the technology that we are using today. Network, wireless, Windows, databases, object-oriented programming, blah, blah, blah. They have everything. In 93, graphical design and aesthetics comes into this field. So because it's for ordinary uses, because it's a screen-based, whatever you like about that, a screen-based interface, the browser, because of the browser, it becomes graphical design. Only now interaction design, it's called interface design at this time, start to develop into interaction design. Oh, and with the mobile phone, you have a nomadic design, you have smaller devices, something you bring with you, and you have to interact, and you have the embryo also for the Internet of Things. With social design, with Twitter, Facebook, and Google, and Amazon, and so on, 2004, you start to think about and the embryo for the start of the service design and so on is based in much in this social design paradigm that begins maybe 2004. And now we're in 2010 and up today. The Internet of Things, where the computers are so small, so you can put them in anything. We go from big machines to computers, laptops. It's not actually mobile. You can have it in your lap, but to smartphones. And now it's even smaller things. So I can have a chip in my body. I can swallow it. I have friends who run the New York Marathon with senders in the stomach, sending on the Internet how they... And I watch my father, actually, when he takes skis, cross-country skiing, Vasaloppet in Sweden. A big race, a big public race. And I can watch him on the Internet. Yeah. I won't comment on that, since it's my father. So. The thing, and this is also the Google car. And maybe Google car is the best example of this. Because here you have it's a cross-media. You understand? This is a car. You're not driving it. It drives itself. So it has to be connected to other cars and to databases and to traffic and to weather and to... But it's a lot of things communicating with each other. It communicates with the traffic signs, of course. And And in the future, this will be much more safer than driving on your own, because this will never sleep, and hopefully it won't break down. Of course, it will break down, but the thing is, it already knows and stops when the car. It knows when the car before you stops. That I, yeah, you understand. But to do design like this, you can't only have a team focusing on the screen, or on the audio, or on the databases, or on what you do on the bathroom, or what you do when you sit down, when you're not in the bathroom. You have to have somebody that works across, only not only cross media, but also cross different contexts, and you have to listen carefully to psychologists and what they tell you about the different situations and how you react and so on. It might be self-driving, but designing it is not something you do on your own. And yeah, now this is we can look at it afterwards, but a take on this cross media and Internet of Things is actually a project by Yoko Ono. Yoko Ono, who was married to John Lennon, one of the Beatles, and she made a concept. She makes a lot of interactive art and a lot of exhibitions. She's an artist, and she made a project in the 60s that she couldn't realize until very recently. And she calls it the Imagine Peace Tower. And of course, it's named after the tune, the song, Imagine. Imagine all the people. And it's about sending wishes via a lot of different channels. It's also about making a wish tree, which is a Japanese Shinto tradition, also a Jewish tradition, a wish tree. You write your wish and you put it up in a tree, and you can watch and read other wishes and so on, or prayers. It's also a tower when you can send messages to that, and that will blink some sort of Morse code. Mostly when it's Yoko Ono, it's something about love sending out. And you are also, when you send via Twitter or mails or so, you can send your wish, and you will be represented by a dot on a 3D map. So your wish is here on the internet. It's cross media. It's physical from the tower, but it's also in all those different channels. This is something new, not something new for you, is it? The technology, no. But it's used here in a social, artistic context. Okay, so this is really what I had to say. So I will look at the clock now. So it's a bit late. So let's just give you 10 minutes.
Let's take 10 minutes and we can turn to talk. Is that okay? Thank you.
Tatt opp. Ja. Det er tatt opp. Det ligger allerede ute. To måter, det ligger på to måter til og med. Det ligger et sånt collaborate-rom der. Jeg vet jo ikke hva som blir bra opptak og om lyden blir bra og sånt. Så. Og så ligger det et sånt felles. Ja, ja. Vi finner på Blackboard og Blackboard Collaborate. Skal legge...
Nei, det skal være i orden, da. Det skal gå an det beste å sette opp en Eduroam-tilknytning, men...
Ja, det den der...
Nei, det beste som ofte fungerer best er jo Eduroam, men jeg vet ikke om det går an å bruke for studenter like bra. Så jeg vet ikke, du må spørre IT, altså, jeg har ikke... Jeg tror ikke det nede her nå, nei. Ok, skal vi starte? Just some practical stuff that we managed to fix now. We try to add a little bit of redundancy when it comes to recordings here. So what I've done now is that I've created a link on your Blackboard page to something called Collaborate. And in my case, I will use Collaborate to both record, which reminds me again, I always forget this, start session, start recording. I both stream the lectures here. We'll probably try to make the others do the same thing, at least with the lecture parts. So we stream them in Collaborate and record them in Collaborate so you can get access to them. It's hard to guarantee the quality of audio, for instance, on these things. But this comes in then in addition to the recording that you get from the room here. So in your left menu you will find now a new link called Collaborate. And the same goes for the scientific methodology class I had earlier today. So there you can also get access to recordings of 2 hours. So hopefully you can use this. But it may be necessary to leave this Collaborate now and then if for some more advanced stuff on when it comes to slides. Yeah, you can just join. Feel free to join. That's good. Where you also can, I'll just skip a few of the first slides here now, because what I'm going to do now is that I'm going to try to talk a little bit about, well, it says that I'm going to talk about guidelines. I will get to guidelines, and I will show them to you, but they're easily available everywhere. The point now is that I'm going to talk a little bit about the way to the guidelines. Why did we get there? Why have we written them down? Because they're somewhat similar, all of them. I'll try to bring you a little bit on the way there now, but also create some background for the rest of this my lectures that will deal with how humans process information, how we perceive information, how our senses work, stuff like that. And now and then bear over that I don't necessarily follow the book from page to page, but I try to follow it in a reasonable way. So, good interfaces. We all want to make them. Right? That's not a big issue. Still, we do a lot of mistakes. In everyday activities, in industry, serious mistakes, quite banal mistakes. And based on this, we have learned a lot. And it's some of this learning that you could say have led us to some of the guidelines for good user interfaces. What makes interfaces good? What makes them good has led to the, or no, sorry. What makes them bad is what has led us to guidelines for how they can be good. complicated. So let's just take some. Let's take the most dramatic ones first. So this is basic human factors. There's a lot of different areas where we know that human error has led to disasters, near disasters. Actually, say when it comes to, for instance, accidents in aviation, over the last years, at least when airplanes have become very automated, it's usually human errors that can be contributed to the errors that are made. A very traditional one, which also has something to do with user interfaces, because an aircraft needs to have an interface, right? You need to read a lot of information about the position of the aeroplane. Does it race? Does it fall? Does it bank to the sides? And in order to do that, they use some kind of thing called an artificial horizon, or it's called different things. Attitude indicator, I think, is another name for the same instrument, and it's duplicated in many ways in an aircraft today. So you have redundant types of information. But this is made in a very strange way, or strange, we don't really know what's good or what's bad, but we know that it can be misinterpreted. Traffic pilots who knows how to fly on instruments and are used to do it, they usually don't do mistakes, but mistakes have been done. What I'm trying to show here is this is the way a traditional artificial horizon is created. So the pilot sees a fixed image of the aeroplane in front of him on this instrument, and the ground is moving relative to the fixed position of the aircraft, which of course is one way to do this. The opposite would be to do what's done here, that you actually, independent of the where the pilot is, you tilt the airplane and keep the horizon straight. It's actually the difference between a traditional Russian design. The mid one is a traditional Russian design, which they have, I think, gone returned from and gone to the standard one. But these are two very different ways to create the illusion of where an aircraft is according to the ground. And we know from a number of accidents that misinterpretation of these instruments actually have led to major disasters. Because what is the case when we don't see the real horizon, and you are either in a either rising or falling while you go to one of the sides, you can create illusionary experiences that you actually are maybe stable, even if you are turning, for instance. And you can get into dramatic things called the graveyard spiral, where you actually you lose speed and you fall down, which a few aircrafts have done. And based on this, one has, well, one thing is that you're always making sure that you have two pilots, for instance, who are communicating how these indicators are in different conditions when you fly on instruments. So there you can do organizational things to prevent this. But you can also do what's done to the right there. You can do combinations which makes them much easier to interpret, where you turn both the aeroplane and the horizon. So you do a combination of the two ways to display this, which is proven to make this a bit more readable. But it's controversial, because this has to do with standardization. But the point is, from these types of accidents, one has learned a few things. that it's not intuitively easy to read displays like the one on the bottom. But, well, we do things in a traditional way anyway. And, of course, it's not necessarily a big thing for traffic pilots, but it is a big thing for, I think, one of the Kennedy brothers. I don't know which one. He came into, was a more like an amateur pilot, and he came into a graveyard spiral once he flew into some clouds because he misinterpreted this very basic instrument. Do you know this history? No. Yes, I think it was Robert Kennedy or something on his way to Martha's Vineyard when he dropped down and killed all his family. Okay. So these are all, of course, very dramatic things, and one that has really pushed the, or an accident that really pushed the focus on human factors and the need for taking human information processing and how we intuitively read instruments into account when you design things was a near, very near nuclear disaster, which maybe changed the whole industry when it came to developing or introducing new nuclear power plants. It was the Three Mile Island accident in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, you say, where this TMI-2 reactor nearly melted down. It had a dramatic loss of coolant. I won't go into it. You can find tons of information on this accident on the web. If you search for TMI-2 accident, you can find all this explanation. But what the basic thing is that the accident happened quite rapidly. There was a valve who was standing out open, so and it was left open, but was misread by the crew as being closed, so they took precautions against and even bypassed this valve that they thought was closed to make the flow easier, which created an even bigger problem, which again led to a very long and very difficult to handle situation. The basic error was a small one, and the power plant's automatics treated that in a very good way. But there were some maintenance systems that there were some redundant systems that were taken out. So there was an organizational part of this as well. But the basic problem was that the operators really misread the situation and couldn't diagnose it. I don't know if you have if you have seen nuclear power plant control rooms. There, in this is the Three Mile Island control room. There are a huge number of dials, of buttons, of lights, of alarms, and a lot of these alarms are either on or off at a normal basis. Like if you turn down power too much, or if you do something, some corrective measures, or if you have some maintenance work or something, you will have a number of alarms. In this case, you also had an alarm printer, which should be the way to. You have a very complex alarms situation where you may have thousands of alarms, and you're supposed to, based on these alarms, try to diagnose the situation. Of course, here you violate a very central thing when it comes to human information processing. We are not very good at handling these amounts of information. And these operators weren't good at handling this, and to worsen things, of course, they had an alarm printer that was 2 hours off the, I think it was lagging 2 hours or something because of the amount of alarms that came there. And to add complexity, they also had these tags which said something about the maintenance work and Said something about alarms, that well, this alarm is actually supposed to be on because this system is under maintenance, so don't worry about this one. One of these were a bow, another indicator, a dial that could actually be used to indicate what's wrong. So it had to do with design, it had to do with organizational issues, it had to do with the way information was provided to operators. In these kinds of environments today, you have all sorts of computer aids to assist operators in actually being able to handle information amounts in this, you could say at this multitude. It's so complex. And in the Gmail at Mile Island situation, there actually had to be a new shift coming in before they were able to handle the situation, because they could see things with new eyes and fresh eyes. So it also says something about when we are stuck, when we have a hypothesis of what's wrong, we tend to stick to that hypothesis instead of trying to step back and try to analyze the situation, which is also a human trait which leads to error and which has helped us at developing guidelines for what a good user interface should be, but it doesn't have to be this dramatic. And the examples I will show you now are examples that you may have seen. Some of you have seen them. Some of you are very familiar with this, because it's examples that mainly are taken from Donald Norman's book, The Design of Everyday Things, originally published as The Psychology of Everyday Things, which is maybe the closest we have come to a best-selling book in our area. It was quite high on charts. So I guess you have read that, or if you haven't, do it. It's nice reading. So what he does in this book, among other things, of course, is to look at all the everyday mistakes that we do and try to explain them, because we interface with a lot of things, and not only computers, and those practical things have in many ways led to the guidelines that we see. So again, a focus on mistakes, not what we are good at, which maybe is a discussion here which you can bring up later. Bad design is often corrected in some way. So a good or one way to discover when, at least in the public places, when a good way to detect what's wrong or what's bad is to see measures that have been taken to avoid errors. And small messages is usually a very good example of this. Just recently I went to I think it was some kind of a fast food restaurant selling some big bites or something like that, selling baguettes, and they had a standard design where they had a very nice glass desk where they put the stuff, and then there was a railing and there was a gap between the two, and they have obviously had to put signs everywhere along that glass desk to say that there is a gap here, because you didn't see it. So they probably had a problem with all the cups that fell down on the floor or something. This may be, I don't know what they've used this for. Males maybe know what this one probably have been used for. But it says this is a mop sink, used for mops, not for peeing in, probably. I'm not sure, but it's at least it's a very it's an example of this type of corrective measures. So it gives us indicators that the thing here tries to send some signals to its users, and then we're going to probably you're going to hear the word affordances later. They send out signals for how they should be used, like a door handle sends signals that it should be pushed down and maybe not up, or if you leave it and only have a sheet on the door, well, you push it. Right? If you have a handle, you may try to pull it. So these kind of signals given away from objects is, well, they are so, when they send out these signals and shouldn't do, well, you try to handle it with signs like this or do other measures. It has led to these kind of problems. And we also know that if you can do mistakes, you probably will do them. Alongside the word affordances comes another word, which is called constraints, which is limitations to these usage signals that an object gives you. In this case, I don't know the example. This example is maybe a good one. Fridge. That's good. Are usually made so that they can open both ways, right? Because this is kitchens are different, so you can usually rearrange them by loosening a few screws and do a few small actions. And some producers are just to make things even simpler. They make handles on both sides. And I guess most of you have experienced situations where you meet such a situation where you try to drag on the wrong side of a fridge, right? Where you move the whole thing. So there is an obvious way to handle this, of course, and that is to blend out or to make sure that you actually can't use that handle. In a lot of these types of general designs, you have these kind of usage problems. The other example has more to do with affordances, where a handle is used to looks like the rest of the stuff you can open, the shelves. Other things we've learned is that people tend to act rationally. We tend to do what's easiest for us to do. And that usually feels natural, so we won't necessarily stick to routines that's written down or that's expected from the user or the designer. When there is a shortcut we can make, we try to make them. Some call this if you walk around a campus like this, for instance outside the A building, there is a park arrangement that goes a bit out in the road there. There is a path going straight over there, and that came there quite soon after they developed the park. So what they should have done, of course, was to wait and see where people were moving. So often referred to as ecological design, that you actually observe what people do before you finish your design. So you could maybe at a later stage just look at where people were walking. So instead of putting up signs that you're not allowed to walk there, You can make a path there. That's good design. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I know. It's often used. It's often referred to as ecological design, and so you. And what we learn here is that, and what we will see back in the guidelines is that people have their natural ways of doing things, and we tend to be quite rational when it comes to these things. So we follow the path of least resistance. So observe and analyze what people actually do, and not don't expect them to do what you think they should do. So that's also something that leads to a design guideline. Another area that we have seen as difficult for humans to do, especially parts of the population, is to do spatial rotation of objects. Maps is a very difficult thing to create. We have a very nice feature now, or all these devices we have now, the GPSs we have now, usually have as default setting to not to orient up as north, but to orient up as in front of your nose, right? So that's a way to handle this. But being when you walk south and we have to rotate a map 180 degrees or even worse 90 degrees from where you're walking is extremely computing demanding for humans to do. This is just an example that I took from the basement in the old A building, where you have a corridor going in that way. You're standing up here, and this is the corridor that you show here, goes in there. And nobody can find these rooms, of course. It's so designing so that you have to do mental rotations is something you should avoid. Has led to guidelines like we can go back to that when you see the guidelines. A lot of errors is done when there is a gap between what you are going to operate and the operators that you have. It's in a very straightforward way, when the buttons aren't where the stuff you're going to operate is, and when they are arranged in another way. Usually on the spot find examples of this. I haven't gone in this room now. There aren't very many buttons, but if there were buttons for, let's say, screens and curtains and stuff like that, you would probably find some strange arrangements with these things, which have us as new in a room do all sorts of mistakes. We turn on all the lights, turn off all the lights before we find the controls that actually maps the lights that we're going to control. This is handled today by creating a closeness between either spatially at one board or at the computer screen, or you say around in a room where there is a spatial relationship between the buttons and what you're going to operate with the buttons. So for instance, this example is from old car designs for electric window elevators. Of course, design-wise, or I guess for practical reasons, they try to make all the cabling come to one place, and it's nice to have that central in the car and not on the doors, for instance. So you put this button somewhere in the center of the car, which was demanding. You didn't necessarily find this. You had to learn where the different buttons were. On cars today, you usually find this automatically. because they have it's established as a standard to put the buttons on right under the window that you're going to control. So that makes these things much simpler. And so use the design principle, maybe called closure or something like that. Use some gestalt principles for design to make these things more easy for you to do. Okay. Which may be the problem when it comes to using Blackboard for presenting things. But I have a backup. So we'll do this now. And hopefully we still do some recordings in the end. Another thing, what I'm going to talk about now is of course, well, this is when it comes to usability and invitations for human error. Remote controls have been kind of a disaster area because they all seem to be quite different. But because we have done some over time, standards have been established to handle this. So for instance, in a remote control, you typically actually expect what button to push when you want to change volume, for instance, on the TV. Which one would you use? Would you use up and down? I would use up and down for channel change, I think. And I would use left and right for volume. I think that's isn't that established? Okay, then maybe I do mistakes then. But at least these basic controls at least have been oriented around this this clock in the middle. So most remote controls have this element in some way, and they have a certain arrangement of buttons, for instance, which allows you to use them only tactile and not so you don't have to look at all the signs, which is difficult for us. We're bad at searching, especially when it's when all these buttons are so similar, so no one actually points out except for this wheel thing, which make this one much easier to discover. And they put on redundancy on these keys so you can control things in many ways and so on. Feedback. Give users feedback where they expect to find the feedback, where they actually are looking. Because we are not very good at detecting things that we don't have in our central vision. I'll come back to that when we are talking about the vision system and visual perception. It has cognitive issues. Yeah, we want to have focus at one point all the time, but it's also it also has to do with the how our vision system works and how it's designed. And we have a lot of examples of difficulties coming from situations like this, where you are doing something on one screen and then you're expected to do other actions on another screen. You're probably used to this, but you will still see people of a generation or two above you who have really difficulties when it comes to handling NSPS ticket machine, self-service ticket systems. Because what they do, I think it's because of legal issues, is that you do a lot of the interaction on one screen, but then when you pay, you're supposed to change focus towards a payment screen. And you say that, of course on the main screen, but then you have to read a lot, or you have to be experienced enough to understand that this is the situation, which is also of course a way around this. But this change of focus creates all sorts of difficulties. So create feedback where feedback is expected. Do the actions where actions are expected. And of course, do it in a way that that people understand. So this is a typical catch-22. If you're, let's say you were asking AppleCare about cookies, what is meant by cookies and how do I set them? If you get the error message that cookies needs to be enabled in your browser in order to access this information, how do you handle that? So in order to understand the error message, you don't need the error message. Or this is kind of a situation we see maybe too often. And this has then led to some of the design guidelines. We are listing up Schneidermans, and you can find them in your in this textbook. Ben Schneidermann was a pioneer on graphical user interfaces and usability. Came out with a book in the late 80s, where he lay out some principles for user interface or for usability. But it has been updated a number of times after that. Of course, it has this some of the phenomena that I've mentioned so far, like strive for consistency, do it the way others do it, and the same way through the system. Offer informative feedback. Follow the principle of closure. Do things in a locked way, so that all actions are done in the same place. Avoid errors. Give us ways out of the situation. So it should be possible to go back. Give people control. Minimize memory load. Like you shouldn't have to. If you are required to remember things, you can't use your somewhat limited resources on the stuff you're going to do, where you remember things. So these are also central things. What has come in as a new one here, I think at least sometime in the, maybe in the 1998 version, but I think later, is the universal usability thing, which has different names, but has to do with access to a system, no matter how you do it when it comes to senses. Like a blind user should be able to use it, even if you have tremors in your hands, you should be able to use the system. Even if you have a hearing loss, it should be possible for you to use it, which of course puts out a new set of requirements on the system. You have Schneidermann's guidelines. Another set of guidelines comes from Jacob Nielsen, 95. Some of them are also taken out into heuristics for or rules of the thumb for checking usability in systems, where they are looking at as you can see, well, if you go into detail, there are probably they differ on a few items, but these guidelines tend to be kind of similar in their nature. They look quite similar, I'd say. We have a third one here from Stone et al., 2005. Where you can find the same words, more or less. Visibility, affordance, feedback, simplicity, structure, consistency, tolerance, and again, accessibility as an issue, which is the same as universal design in this context. Strive for that. And of course, this is based on knowledge about how we are. Knowledge about how we perceive information, how we handle information in different ways, how we learn, and of course our habits, how we are used to act on different things. So the guidelines, they're not very dramatic. They come out of these experiences, this structured experience we have from the real world. But the problem is, of course, that they don't necessarily give you they don't necessarily give you very detailed advice on practical designs. They can be operationalized towards that, but it's not obvious that that's easy all the time. So the reason I said this is that in order to use these types of guidelines in a good way, you should also know why they are there, because that may help you to make design decisions at a later stage. So guidelines is nice, and they're easy to look at, and they are, I can't say that one set of guidelines when it comes to user interface design is better than the other guidelines, because they all tend to deal with the same issues, but they don't necessarily lead to good designs, because I think you have to know the reason behind them in order to do this in a good way. I think maybe this is a place we can stop now for this part and give you a little lunch here. I've had a few hours of lecture today, and I will have even one more, so I would be happy to do that. Tomorrow I will start talking about the principles of our, to say, the sensory system, especially with a focus then on vision. What is vision and what is perception? Is it 9:30 tomorrow? Yeah, I'm ready 9:30, no problem. Is it here? This room, 9:30 tomorrow.
And for everybody else, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
You can make all your questions tomorrow if you like.
I'll be around anyway. This, that. Ja, jeg har ikke lagt ut det her foilene jeg brukte nå.